journalist. We have a special prosecution for crimes against freedom of expression, which they have presented no results in the ever. Not so ever. We wanted to say a date, but they haven't presented any results on the murders of Moisés Sánchez, of the murders of Regina Martínez in Veracruz as well. She used to be a colleague with Rubén in the Proceso magazine. So our demands are quite clear. We wanted a full investigation. And I think, yeah, there is a responsibility from all parts of the government, the federal, the state, and the municipal government, for the systematic impunity of crimes against human rights defenders and crimes against journalists. We can actually talk about a systematic impunity because in Article 19, we documented 88 cases since 2000. And none of them
Sebastian, we're going to have to leave it there. But, of course, we will continue to cover this. Sebastian Aguirre with Article 19, Laura Carlson, Center for International Policy, and Andalusia Knoll, independent journalist. We will link to her piece at AJ+. We have a job opening for social media editor, full-time job. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Tuesday KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Waterfront Park in Portland. 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki will feature speakers and performers, including Portland Taiko, and will provide opportunities for attendees to get involved in efforts to abolish nuclear weapons. That's 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts. The Montevilla Jazz Festival showcases the best of Portland-based artists, including the Alan Jones Sextet, the Ed Bennett Quintet, Machete Order, and Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th, and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon LNG faces a setback in its plan to build an export terminal on the Oregon coast.
The family of an anti-police brutality activist found dead in a Texas jail cell last month have filed a wrongful death lawsuit.
Republican attempts to defund Planned Parenthood have failed for the time being.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 4th, 2015. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. The natural gas company Oregon LNG has received a setback in its plans to build a $6 billion terminal in Warrenton. A federal magistrate judge last Tuesday concluded that Oregon LNG's challenge to an Army Corps of Engineers easement in Warrenton came too late. At an interagency meeting in 2009, the Army Corps of Engineers raised concerns that the project could intersect with dikes and levees on the easement and conflict with the disposal of dredge spoils. According to the Daily Historian, Oregon LNG claimed that the Army Corps, which has held an easement to deposit dredging spoils since 1957, has no right to land beneath the water on which the terminal and pipeline would be built. Oregon LNG has brushed off other adverse rulings against the project, which involves an 87-mile pipeline from Washington State through Columbia, Tillamook, and Clatsop counties to an export terminal on the Skipanon Peninsula in Warrenton. The company said the courtroom setback will have little impact on its ability to secure permission to develop the project. However, environmentalists, fishermen, and many residents in Warrenton and Astoria have celebrated every potential setback for Oregon LNG as victories that could doom the project. The company expects to begin construction on the terminal in the third quarter of 2016 and plans for it to be commissioned by the third quarter of 2020.
The South Dakota Public Utilities Commission hearing on the Keystone XL pipeline continued today, with TransCanada representatives facing questions from the lawyers for local residents and tribes. TransCanada is the pipeline corporation that's continuing to push for a massive oil pipeline extending from Canada all the way to the coast of Texas. Julie Dermansky, a blogger with the DSmog blog who was attending the hearing, reported that a team of lawyers representing Native American tribes and the grassroots group Dakota Rural Action took the upper hand during the proceedings as they tried to have a TransCanada executive's testimony impeached. She said the commissioners seemed unsure of the commission's own procedures. Here's a clip of some of today's testimony in which a TransCanada official faces questions from a local resident.
This is Gary Doerr, individual intervener. Is it statistically possible for an entire area, would an entire area be entirely upgrading statistically of a pipeline?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I'll try to answer. The entire length of the pipeline in South Dakota crosses multiple aquifers, which have different gradients. So if you're at that scale, that would be a very hard question to answer. Looking at a specific area like a well or a source water area, I think that area could be, depending on the gradient and the flow direction of the aquifer, could be either up gradient or down gradient.
So would slope, terrain, soil, and vegetation all be considerations for determining up gradient?
No, because I'm speaking to the flow direction of the water table, and the surface topography in many cases does not impact the flow direction of the water table. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
So would it be accurate to say that if there was, like, let's say there's a really, really big hill, and if that pipeline leaked, couldn't it leak down to the water source independent of the gradient?
I think there's maybe two things going on and that I'm hearing in your question. The surface topography could be, the pipeline could be uphill from a well or a thing, and that may control the flow of a surface leak. But if we're talking strictly on the groundwater contamination and flow, that surface topography may or may not impact the direction of flow of the groundwater.
Okay, so in your expert opinion, where the pipeline crosses Mr. Harder's land, have you seen that area?
I've seen where it is crosses near the Zone A source water for Colombe. I'm not sure where that is relative to Mr. Harder's land.
Are you familiar with the hill on Mr. Harder's land, which is between 60 and 100 feet higher than the Colombe City water well?
Not specifically.
Okay, it's within 600 feet. As we saw on the map yesterday, if there was a pipeline leak on that hill, in your expert opinion as a hydrologist, couldn't the contamination from an oil spill, even though it's down gradient due to the terrain, still contaminate the city water well?
I would expect the surface flow of an oil spill to flow downhill or down gradient. If the surface flow didn't reach the well but reached straight down into the groundwater, it is going to follow the flow direction of the water, the groundwater. But certainly if it's uphill, the surface flow could and would flow downhill.
One of the observers of the Public Utility Commission hearing reported that commissioners were asleep during key portions of the testimony. The commission hearing in South Dakota is expected to continue until Friday. If the South Dakota Public Utility Commission decides TransCanada isn't up to the task of constructing a safe pipeline route, TransCanada will have to start the entire repermitting process again.
The University of Oregon today announced that it had reached a settlement with an 18-year-old student who alleged that she had been raped last year by three U of O basketball players. The young woman claimed to have been assaulted in a bathroom during an off-campus party following a basketball game on March 9, 2014. Her alleged attackers claimed that the sex was consensual. They were suspended from the team and eventually given a four-year ban from the university. The Lane County District Attorney's Office refused to file charges, so the victim, who has not been named, filed suit in federal court. Under the terms of the settlement, all claims will be dismissed with prejudice, which means that they cannot be refiled. The plaintiff will receive $800,000 from the university, as well as 4 years of tuition, fees, and housing costs. Neither side was afforded attorney's fees or court costs. The settlement does not require the university to admit any liability in the case, nor does it admit to any of the facts presented. The University of Oregon is, however, in the process of hiring an associate vice president and Title IX coordinator in order to strengthen the school's efforts at preventing and responding to rape and at supporting victims.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. When you think of public school teachers, do you see them as bullies who should be punched in the face? New Jersey Governor and GOP presidential hopeful Chris Christie sees teachers that way. Christie has often said bullies deserve a punch in the face. He was asked by CNN's Jake Tapper who nationally deserves a punch in the face.
Oh, the National Teachers Union, who's already endorsed Hillary Clinton 16, 17 months before the election.
Why?
Because they're not for education for our children. They're for greater membership, greater benefits, greater pay for their members. And they are the single most destructive force in public education in America. I've been saying that since 2009. I've got the scars to show it, but I'm never going to stop saying it because they never change their stripes.
American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten has a different take on teachers and public education.
At the end of the day, we know what the issue is. The issue is how you attract and recruit, support, and retain great teachers, particularly in hard-to-staff schools. Frankly, bashing teachers will make it worse, not better. And how do you actually deal with the two real problems that we have in schooling these days, the problem of inequity and income inequality and social immobility, and the problem of underfunding, particularly for our poorest kids? Those are the real problems in schools today. Let's not demonize every single school teacher in the United States of America and suggest that they should be smashed.
The Teamsters are protesting at today's Airgas shareholders meeting at Philadelphia's Franklin Institute. Airgas workers are joining the protest, calling on Airgas to end poor treatment of workers. Earlier this year, Airgas locked out some drivers delivering gases to hospitals, triggering what the Teamsters say was a three-state labor dispute. The Teamsters say Airgas is refusing to bargain a fair contract with its workers. The workers say they're concerned that if Airgas's poor treatment of workers and discriminatory pay practices continue, hospitals could see some service disruptions. Nine New York City car wash workers are suing AJA Car Wash in federal court for $400,000 in allegedly unpaid wages. The suit says workers at AJA are paid as little as $6 and $7 an hour while working as many as 70 hours a week. The Wash New York campaign is a labor community effort to improve working conditions for car wash workers. Since it launched 3 years ago, workers at nine car washes have organized with the retail, wholesale, and department store union. WIN is made possible in part through underwriting support from the United Auto Workers.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A Republican-led effort to end federal funding for Planned Parenthood has failed in the Senate. Last night, 53 members of Senate voted yes on the bill and 46 voted no. This means the bill was just 7 votes short of the 60 that are needed to advance. The fight over funding now shifts to a government funding measure this fall. Conservatives in both the House and Senate are demanding that a provision be attached to any government spending bill in order to block additional federal funds from going to Planned Parenthood. Cecile Richard, president of Planned Parenthood, says that some extreme Republicans may continue to insist on shutting down the government in order to deny health care, including birth control, to millions of women. But, she says, this is a fight that she believes the American people have no appetite for, and a fight which these extremists will not win.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Virtually all activism in the U.S. that has anything to do with corporate power tends to have tactics and strategies that focus almost entirely on a federal or state solution. I find this fact quite troubling, given that we the people do not currently have the political power to successfully influence state or federal legislative lawmaking, and yet our social movements ignore this fact year after year after year. We plead with President Obama to block Shell Oil Company's planned drilling in the Arctic, and when he ignores our pleas, we quickly run out of other ideas for achieving our goal. In Oregon, we plead with Governor Kate Brown to block Nestle Corporation's goal of purchasing the right to bottle spring water near Cascade Locks in the Columbia Gorge, and when she ignores our pleas, we don't exactly have a plan B. We plead with our congresspeople to vote no on national legislation banning state governments from writing their own laws on GMO agriculture, which was written to benefit Monsanto Corporation, and when they ignore our pleas, there's little we can do. It doesn't seem to matter much what the issue is, the building of new coal-fired power plants, the promotion of the latest global corporate trade treaty outrage like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the clear-cutting of our last remaining ancient forests, etc. Activist communities invest an unbelievable amount of time, money, and energy trying to pressure our federal and state elected leaders to do the right thing, and we almost always lose. You know the old adage that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. I really don't enjoy pointing out this obvious fact because it's always very good people working very hard. Everyone's heart is in the right place, but somehow we fail to notice that we're acting an awful lot like hamsters on a wheel. Imagine instead a fundamentally different strategy where we come to terms with the fact, albeit a very painful one, that we mostly cannot win at the federal or state level these days, simply because we're outgunned by corporate lobbyists, corporate candidates, and corporate money. But we still can win at the municipal and county level. Most activists assume that's not a scale of government where we can accomplish very much, but I beg to differ with that assumption. In fact, I would argue it is currently the most effective level of government for us to be organizing. In fact, the community rights movement has achieved one major win after another at the local level, now with 200 communities in 9 states, that have already passed locally enforceable laws that ban harmful corporate activities and rein in corporate so-called rights. Imagine for a moment a fundamental shift in conventional organizing. Imagine communities along the Keystone XL pipeline route passing community rights ordinances that ban the pipeline's passage through their towns. Isn't that a lot less work than trying to get Obama to veto the project? Imagine cities and towns across the country nullifying the implementation of these outrageous corporate trade treaties within their municipal boundaries. In fact, some of our communities already have. Imagine cities that host major universities passing local laws that ban corporate funding of university research, so that we can finally get back to trusting the scientific process again and taking back public control over all scientific research. Imagine counties that currently host dangerous nuclear power plants passing locally enforceable laws that shut down these disasters that are waiting to happen. Imagine rural counties that depend on logging for their economic health, passing local laws that take logging decisions out of the hands of corporate boards of directors and into the hands of public participatory processes. Imagine counties in the Midwest passing community rights laws that ban any more factory farms from being built there. Imagine counties passing laws along the routes of the oil and coal trains destined for Pacific Coast ports that ban the local passage of those oil and coal trains. Imagine major cities passing locally enforceable laws that set new minimum standards for the performance of corporate-owned mainstream media institutions and revoke their right to continue in those cities if they refuse to fulfill their new higher level of responsibility to their readers and viewers. Imagine Hood River County passing a community rights law that bans corporate mining of spring water for bottling. Imagine Portland's voters passing a law that gives neighborhoods the authority to prohibit major corporate developments that don't meet the vision that the neighbors have for where they live. Imagine communities passing laws that ban locally operating banks from foreclosing on homeowners except when absolutely necessary. Imagine cities passing bans on the building of toxic waste incinerators. Is it really that crazy for our activist communities to reconsider how they are focusing their efforts, especially given the fact that most of the time we lose and the corporations win? Time is quickly running out for our species on planet Earth. If we don't figure out how to become a lot more effective in our efforts towards ecological protection and economic and social justice, is it that crazy a notion that our activism could shift almost entirely towards the local, passing community rights laws that begin to effectively transition our cities, towns, and counties towards truly sustainable practices? Everyone lives somewhere. Can we not imagine each and every somewhere becoming a place where the people are mobilized to defend where they live from any further corporate harms? If 200 communities in 9 states have already achieved this remarkable feat, is it that crazy to dream about thousands of communities passing these laws over the next few years? It is time to dream big. It's time to shift gears. It's time to move our energy away from trying to influence our so-called leaders who are refusing to lead, and instead to mobilize ourselves in the places that each of us live. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CienfuegosPaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening. And remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Preference at 6. Hosted by Alan Silver, Preference is a queer experiment in radio. Tonight, artist Jason Ingram joins us to talk about his exhibit and performance this month at Q Center. They call it Mercy, based on his personal experience of participating in gay reparative therapy, now outlawed in Oregon. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight, we will see increasing clouds with a low around 58, and tomorrow, cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny with a high near 74. Today in history, in 1944, Anne Frank and her family were found in Amsterdam by the Gestapo. In 1964, the bodies of 3 civil rights workers were found in an earthen dam, 6 weeks into a federal investigation backed by President Johnson. The quote of the day is from Carol Anderson, Associate Professor of African American Studies at Emory University. She says, "White rage doesn't have to take to the streets and face rubber bullets to be heard. Instead, white rage carries an aura of respectability and has access to the courts, police, legislators, and governors who cast its efforts as noble, though they are actually driven by the most ignoble motivations."
It's 5:24. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Back in 2008, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein declared, "There are parts of government that can be run like a business and should be run like a business." Thus, the chairwoman of the Senate Committee overseeing congressional facilities privatized the restaurants and other food services in the U.S. Senate. Sure enough, those dining spots now turn a profit because they are being run like a business, specifically a business like McDonald's. Restaurant Associates, the New York outfit that got the House and Senate food contract, profits by paying poverty-level wages and generally mistreating the cooks, waitstaff, and other people who put the service in food service. Wages are less than $11 an hour, well below the very expensive cost of living in the Washington area. "Everybody has second jobs," says one weary worker. And when our $174,000 a year members of Congress adjourn for the 3 months or so of vacations they take each year, the food service workers are sent away with no pay at all. I should note that Restaurant Associates did give a pay raise to some workers not long ago. It was 3 cents an hour. That's not a raise, it's an insult. "I serve food to some of the most powerful people on earth," says a Senate cook. "They often talk of expanded opportunity for workers, but most don't seem to notice or care that workers in their own building are struggling to survive." Care? A key Senate committee chairman, Representative Tom Graves, recently showed how much Congress cares about the inequality by refusing even to consider requiring food service contractors to pay a living wage. "It's really not within the scope of this committee to micromanage all contracts," he sniffed. This is Jim Hightower saying, think of how that makes the Capitol dining staff feel. If I was old Tom, from now on, I wouldn't eat anywhere in the Capitol without taking a food taster with me.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The family of the late civil rights activist Sandra Bland has filed a federal lawsuit against officials in Houston. Sandra Bland died last month in a Texas jail cell while under police custody. She was only 28 and had been pulled over for making a lane change without signaling. The lawsuit has been filed against State Trooper Brian Encinia and all officials involved in Bland's arrest and incarceration. The action was prompted by what they called inconsistencies in the investigation into Bland's death and the unwillingness of authorities in Waller County, Texas, to share information with the Bland family. An autopsy conducted by the Harris County Institute of Forensic Sciences concluded Bland had used a plastic bag to hang herself. Family members dispute the autopsy findings and contend that Bland was killed by someone inside the jail. Bland's mother said that she is convinced that her daughter did not commit suicide, as the police department claimed. She has also said that Sandra should never have been in that jail cell to begin with. The FBI is investigating Bland's death and has said they cannot comment on the investigation.
The number of people who died while behind bars in the U.S. has risen for the third straight year, according to new research by the Justice Department. The Bureau of Justice Statistics reported today that in 2013, more than 4,400 people died in prisons and jails combined. Just under 1,000 of those were in the custody of local jails. The largest single reported cause of death among jail inmates was suicide, with 327 reported inmate deaths. Only 28 deaths in jails were reported as homicides. The biggest single cause of death among people in state prisons was cancer, which claimed more than 1,000 people in prisons, followed by heart disease, which took almost 900. Fewer than 200 people in state prisons were reported to die by suicide in 2013, and fewer than 100 were reported to have died by homicide.
The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee held a hearing earlier today on challenges facing the federal prison system. One of the first witnesses they heard from was Piper Kerman, author of Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Woman's Prison. Ms. Kerman described some of the problems that plague the prison system. Here's part of her testimony.
Women are the fastest growing population in the American criminal justice system, and their families and communities are increasingly affected by what happens to women behind bars. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, 63% of women in prison are there for a nonviolent offense. Many are incarcerated due to substance abuse and mental health issues, which are overwhelmingly prevalent in prisons and jails. And the rate of sexual abuse and other physical violence that women experience prior to incarceration is staggering. Female prisoners suffer these problems at greater rates than male prisoners, and these experiences are relevant both to their crimes and to their incarceration. But these issues are not being adequately addressed by the Bureau of Prisons. The research on criminal justice-involved women and girls shows that the risk factors I mentioned require different approaches in order to reduce women's recidivism and result in successful reentry. This is not unlike findings in other fields, such as healthcare, where research shows that women experience heart attack symptoms quite differently from men, and their treatment needs differ. And this understanding has saved women's lives. The Bureau of Prisons should adopt gender-responsive correctional approaches that interrupt cycles of unnecessary suffering. States like Washington provide a roadmap to do this successfully. When I was locked up in Danbury, I knew women who were trying to raise their children during brief reunions in the visitor's room while fending off sexual harassment and struggling with addiction and trying to get a high school education so that when they got out, they stood some chance of surviving despite their felony conviction. I saw women in Bureau of Prisons denied necessary medical care, and women with mental health issues wait for months to see the one psychiatrist who is available for 1,400 women. And that's unimaginable in a system where at least 65% of women experience some kind of mental illness. Equally shocking were the mandatory reentry classes inmates took to prepare to leave prison. I attended one on housing, which was led by a man who worked in construction in the prison. And the mostly poor and overwhelmingly minority women who were attending that class desperately wanted to know how someone with a felony conviction and few resources could find safe, affordable housing to live in after release. And instead, we heard about fiberglass insulation and roof maintenance and some other home improvement tips. The reentry health classes that we took were taught by a culinary department officer who had no expertise or information on reproductive health, mental health, or substance abuse options post-release. He had, however, played professional baseball for a brief time, and hence his authority on the health topic. Many of Danbury's policies were questionable, but it was relatively close to home for most of the women who were serving time there. Families could visit, children could see their mothers, many of whom were raising their kids on their own before being sent to prison. Yet, the BOP disregarded this when it chose to convert Danbury FCI to a men's facility in 2013. This sent women beyond the BOP's stated goal of no more than 500 miles from home. And it has also deprived many of them of programming that male prisoners enjoy, such as Unicor employment, which is very important, or the residential drug and alcohol treatment program, which not only is one of the most effective programs the BOP has, but also is one of the only ways to earn a sentence reduction in the Bureau. It is worth noting that the desire to empty that prison of women caused the Bureau of Prisons to examine prisoners' sentences and exercise its discretion granted by the Second Chance Act, signed into law in 2008 by President Bush. Hundreds of women were reassigned to complete their sentences in halfway houses or even in home confinement. And while briefly exercised in the case of Danbury FCI, the BOP has not used its authority under the Act to safely reduce the federal prison population and return as many prisoners as possible to their communities. The BOP should place all eligible prisoners in halfway houses or home confinement at the earliest possible dates, and should use compassionate release and sentence reduction programs. And this would help relieve the persistent overcrowding and keep staff and prisoners safer while reducing costs. Finally, The BOP must be led by individuals who value the role of communities and families in rehabilitation and understand the particular needs of women. We appreciate the service of Director Samuels, and he leaves at the end of this year. He should be replaced by a leader who is committed to enacting these values into policy. I urge the administration to look outside of the existing Bureau leadership for strong candidates who will make the BOP a model system driven by innovation and creativity.
That was Piper Kerman, author of Orange is the New Black, testifying earlier today before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee on problems in the federal prison system.
Police officer Andrew Halpin of Sarasota, Florida, resigned today after allegedly forcing a handcuffed man to eat food from a jail floor. Halpin was due to meet with the department's internal affairs investigator today. In an apparent admission of guilt, he resigned preemptively, but has not faced any charges for his actions. Last week, a video was made public that shows Halpin degrading and humiliating the prisoner, and he was put on paid administrative leave. His police chief, Bernadette Tipino, viewed the video and expressed disappointment at what she had seen. The inmate involved was an unidentified, intoxicated homeless man arrested for trespassing on July 18th. The video in question showed Halpin throwing food at the suspect's mouth, which predictably resulted in it falling to the floor of his cell. As the handcuffed and intoxicated man attempted to retrieve the food, Halpin repeatedly stepped on it with his boot to shove it forward.
In Kentucky, a deputy sheriff handcuffed two disabled elementary school children, according to a federal lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union. Kevin Sumner, the deputy sheriff, works as a school resource officer at Latonia Elementary School. The 8-year-old boy and 9-year-old girl that were handcuffed both have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and the ACLU says that both children were being punished for behavior related to their disabilities. The children were so small that Sumner cuffed their biceps because the handcuffs did not fit their wrists. The ACLU is suing on behalf of the two children, claiming that Sumner violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. Cell phone video obtained by the ACLU shows one incident where Sumner talks to the 8-year-old boy who has been handcuffed to a chair. After crying out that he is hurt, the deputy says, quote, "You can do what we've asked you to, or you can suffer the consequences. If you want the handcuffs off, you're going to have to behave and ask me nicely." The handcuffs were removed after about 15 minutes. One of the children is black and the other is Latino.
According to a report released today by the UK's Guardian newspaper, an Alabama police officer remains unpunished despite clear evidence that he hatched a plan to murder a black man in cold blood. The officer, Troy Middlebrooks of Alexander City, allegedly proposed murdering city resident Vincent Bias, saying that Bias, quote, "needs a bullet," end quote, and referred to him with a common racial slur. Middlebrooks' plan involved planting false evidence to suggest that the planned killing was in self-defense. The motive appeared to be retribution over a prior run-in between the two, which resulted in a minor drug charge against Bias. The evidence comes from a secret recording from 2013, which was later played to Alexander City's police chief and mayor. Middlebrooks has, nonetheless, kept his job without disciplinary action and continues to serve actively in the city after city leaders paid Bias $35,000 to settle a lawsuit. Police Chief Willie Robinson defended his subordinate, saying that Middlebrooks was, quote, "just talking," and didn't really mean what he said on the recording, in spite of his formation of a fairly detailed and premeditated plan. Middlebrooks' comments followed a call to Bias's home involving an unleashed dog. His secretly recorded remarks were made to Bias's brother-in-law, who is white, while Bias himself was within the house. The officer said that he was tired of Bias, again using a racial slur, being released from jail after a prior drug conviction for which Bias was released on bail. On the same visit, Middlebrooks also said that if he were in the brother-in-law's place, he would kill Bias and inflict minor injuries on himself to make it appear that the murder was self-defense. He also mocked the brother-in-law with homophobic language. Chief Robinson, on this basis, again defended Middlebrooks, claiming that he ought to be absolved since he was only suggesting that Bias's brother-in-law commit the murder. However, the officer's language seemed to suggest a personal vendetta and personal intent, as well as blatantly obvious racist sentiment.
Border Patrol is out of control! The Border Patrol is out of control!
The Border Patrol is out of control!
That was the sound of protesters chanting queer and trans in isolation. Why does ICE incarcerate them? Yesterday, a busy downtown Seattle intersection was shut down by protesters for about 2 hours. More than 30 people stood outside the Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Their anger was directed at the partnership between ICE and the GEO Group, one of the country's largest private prison companies. A contract between ICE and the GEO Group guarantees 800 detention center beds be filled at any given time. Katie Rickman from the Trans and/or Women's Action Camp, or TWAC, says quotas give ICE agents incentive to round up immigrants. The activist group, which joined the Not One More Detention movement, wanted to point out trans people are usually sent to solitary confinement. The group's left without any arrests.
A new report by Education Northwest has found that students from non-English-speaking immigrant families in Oregon schools were more likely to be expelled or suspended than non-English learner students. The report also shows that students who had been suspended or expelled got lower scores on achievement tests than those who had not been suspended or expelled. I spoke with Art Burke from Education Northwest to find out more. First of all, could you explain what is an English learner?
English learners are students who have limited proficiency in English. They may be immigrant students newly arrived, or they may be students who have been born in the United States but live in homes where English is not the first language.
Your report looked at the discipline imposed on English learner students versus non-English learner students. What did you find?
Well, that's right, Doug. We looked at discipline of English learner students and non-English learner students in six districts that are members of the Oregon Leadership Network, and these districts commissioned the study to be proactive in helping them address inequities in assignment of discipline and achievement.
Now, the Oregon Revised Code for Student Discipline calls for schools to try and keep students in class, yet your report shows that non-English learners are being given suspensions and expulsions at a higher rate in middle school and high school than the English learners. What kind of impact does that have?
That's correct, Doug, but remember that this study was conducted on data from the 2011 and 12 school year. The new regulations are coming into effect and districts may have already made some changes.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
And I understand also your report essentially provides a baseline rather than trying to explain possible reasons for any disparities. But what sort of implications do these disciplinary measures have? For students, especially, well, obviously.
Oh, we think that the study has significant implications. Remember that we found that English learners in middle school and high school were suspended or expelled at significantly higher rates than non-English learners. We also found that in high school, English learners were suspended for almost a full day more over the school year than non-English learners. Aggression and insubordination disruption were the most common reasons why English learners and non-English learners were suspended or expelled. And the final thing that emerged from our study was that, on average, English learners who were suspended or expelled had substantially lower levels of achievement on the state assessment than English learners who are not suspended or expelled. So suspension or expulsion imposed an additional penalty of a sort on English learners. Those were the findings.
Moving forward, how can schools use this data to help improve on their performance?
Well, first of all, we hope that these results will spur other districts locally and across the state and across the nation to examine patterns of suspension and expulsion for English learners, and also examine the achievement correlates of suspension and expulsion for those students. Now, more specifically as to how districts can respond to the results, they can search for alternatives to suspending or expelling students. They can examine policies and procedures for disciplining students and identify how these policies and procedures might disadvantage English learners. They can monitor the learning environments in their schools and classrooms to ensure that they support all students. They can provide suspended or expelled English learners with appropriate learning activities if they're ever excluded from their classrooms. And finally, they can provide academic and behavioral support to English learners who return to school after having been suspended or expelled. The last thing I think I would like to add is that we're hoping that districts that examine patterns of suspension and expulsion for English learners will also look at the reasons why these penalties were imposed, and they should be alert to patterns that show that English learners are disciplined more often than English learners for offenses that are identified through administrators' discretion. If this happens, it may signal a need for additional training for schools.